The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello and welcome. This is October in 2011, and the next presidential election will be held more than a year from today, in November of 2012. But already the presidential campaign is taking off and is in full swing, with a tremendous amount of interest being shown, especially, of course, in the Republican campaign. Because the Democratic nominee obviously will be Barack Obama, but the Republican nomination is still up for grabs. And there's been a series of debates by leading Republican contenders for the presidency, including one just a few nights ago. I'm not going to make a detailed analysis of the statements and the responses by the Republicans in this debate to the various questions, but there's two aspects of the debates, or two questions that came up during this most recent debate, that I think reflect and says something about the society we live in, about American political life today, and underscore some a very important aspect of American democratic society, especially this society of mass democracy involving the media and so forth. The debate underscores, I think, points up the lack of seriousness, the lack of principle in American society generally, and the frivolous and pandering way that our politicians operate in an effort to try to be elected president. In the debate the other evening, a question was asked about terrorism, whether any of the candidates would be willing to negotiate with terrorists. Well, predictably, as a knee-jerk reaction, candidate after candidate insisted that he would never negotiate with terrorists. Now, the reason for this, and the reason why politicians are quick to say this, is because the mass of people lack any larger or deeper historical understanding. It sounds good to say, I'm not going to negotiate with terrorists because it sounds tough. And after all, terrorists are bad. They're evil. And the mass of people like to hear politicians who condemn bad guys and make the audience feel like we're part of the good guys. Since terrorism is bad, we shouldn't have anything to do with it, and therefore we're not going to negotiate with terrorists. Now, although this appeals to a lot of people, this outlook and this way of putting things is childish, it's simplistic, and from any historical perspective, it's really pretty stupid. The implication that terrorists are evil or bad and that therefore we shouldn't have anything to do with them or negotiate with them, it's based on a simplistic view. Just any kind of historical perspective makes this obvious. The men who sacrificed to create an independent Ireland in the 20th century, for example, were justifiably condemned as terrorists. In the years before Ireland became an independent state in the early 1920s, the movement for Irish independence was carried out by men whom the British understandably, justifiably condemned as terrorists. The high point of the Irish campaign for independence was the Easter Uprising of 1916, in which Irish nationalists seized control of parts of Dublin, including the post office. A siege took place. The men who were not killed in the uprising and who held out were arrested, and most of the leaders of the Irish nationalist uprising were executed for their role. One of those who was involved was Eamon de Valera. He was commandant of Irish Volunteers, and he escaped being shot himself as one of the leaders of the Irish nationalist uprising, a terrorist uprising and a terrorist movement, because he was born in the United States and was therefore a U.S. citizen. For that reason, he was spared being shot along with other leaders of the Easter uprising. Now, later on, Eamon de Valera became Prime Minister of an independent Ireland. He was Prime Minister of the Irish Free State or Irish Republic during World War II, as well as during much of the 1950s. And later, until his death, he was President of the Irish Republic. Now, the Irish nationalist movement involved quote-unquote terrorism. But this has been characteristic of many movements in the past that most Americans are willing to say were carried out for a good or justifiable cause. And nobody in this right mind, nobody in America would think that the United States shouldn't have had anything to do with Eamon de Valera or other leaders of the Irish nationalist movement after Ireland became a state, because those men had been terrorists. Terrorism is illegal actions of killing, bombing, and physical violence by people in a cause who don't have state power. It's easy to condemn terrorism because violence carried out by a state is never called terrorism. Terrorists are only those who don't have a state. In the world today, especially here in the United States, Palestinian nationalists are called terrorists. Well, the Palestinians don't have an army. They don't have the power to carry out their policies with the same brutal force that Israel does. And so it's easy for Israel, of course, to condemn so-called terrorism because the Palestinians don't have state power in the way that Israel does. But in this debate that took place the other day, and in which Republican candidates were quick to insist that it would never have anything to do with terrorists, negotiating with terrorists, none would be willing to apply that standard to the leaders of Israel. The first group to introduce terrorism into the Middle East were Zionist activists, that is, Jewish nationalists who were seeking to create a Jewish state in Palestine. Two important leaders of the Jewish nationalist movement in Palestine, the Zionist movement, were Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir, both who were condemned by the British, who was the authority in Palestine until 1948, both of whom were condemned as terrorists, and both of whom later became prime ministers of Israel, and were welcomed to the United States with all the fanfare of a leader of a foreign country, even though each of them had well-documented records as terrorists. But they were terrorists at a time when the Zionists did not have a state of their own in Palestine. Once they were in power and Palestinians were seeking justice for themselves and their rights, they carried out acts which Israelis and Americans, of course, condemned as terrorism. But terrorism, again, depends on what side they are and the circumstances. And a blanket statement by Republican leaders that they aren't going to deal with terrorism or terrorists is an example of the kind of rhetoric that is necessary, I suppose, in a mass democracy, because it appeals to the simplistic outlook of the mass of people, even though it is historically a short-sighted and stupid one. From 1979 until 1992, I think it was, for 14 years, there were Soviet troops in Afghanistan. And during that period of time, the United States backed resistance to Soviet control of Afghanistan. Among those people who were in the resistance was Osama bin Laden. And the resistance, the Afghan resistance, carried out numerous acts of terrorism. They would plant bombs, assassinate people, murder Soviet soldiers, and so forth. But the United States not only applauded this. It helped these terrorists with weapons and money and support, because this was part of the U.S. effort to stop the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. And those politicians at this recent debate who insist that they'll never have anything to do with terrorists are saying this because they're appealing to voters who like to think of themselves in a sort of self-righteous way. Now, this is typical in a mass democracy, and it's one of the fundamental weaknesses of a mass democracy, because it means that in order to be elected, political leaders are compelled to say things that appeal to the most simplistic ideas of large numbers of people, but which are childish, simplistic, and stupid. During the debate, another question was asked about U.S. citizenship and whether the candidates were in favor of repealing the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. The 14th Amendment requires states that everyone born in the United States under the jurisdiction of the U.S. is automatically a U.S. citizen. Now, the point of the 14th Amendment, when it was enacted in 1868, was to ensure that former slaves and the children of former slaves would be regarded as U.S. citizens. That was the intent and purpose of that, so that the rights of citizenship of former slaves could not be taken away by southern states in the aftermath of the U.S. Civil War. But the language of the 14th Amendment means that anyone born in the U.S. is automatically a U.S. citizen. There's some debate about whether this could be changed by just legislation, in spite of the clear language of the 14th Amendment itself. But in any case, this is the way the law is written. Now, what's odd about this? There's a number of reasons why this is unusual. The United States is the only major important country in the world where citizenship is given to anyone who's born here. In most of the world, citizenship of a person is determined by the citizenship of the parents. So if a woman from France, for example, has a child in Britain, that child is a French citizen because the mother is a French citizen. Or if American parents have a child in Italy, the child is a U.S. citizen, not an Italian citizen. The U.S. is one of the very few countries in the world that gives citizenship automatically to anyone who is born here, regardless of the circumstances under which the mother or the parents come to the U.S. Now, this makes a mockery of citizenship law, which is one of the most important laws for any country, any society. The rights and duties of a citizen are among the most important that any country can lay out in law. But in our country, the 14th Amendment and American citizenship law is such that there has risen an industry of people who fly here to the United States from China, from Korea, from Turkey, and from other countries. Women who are pregnant come here to the U.S. in these circumstances to have their children in U.S. hospitals. They stay in nice hotels until the time they're supposed to give birth, and then the child born here is automatically a U.S. citizen, so that later the child, when it grows up, has all the advantages of U.S. citizenship, even though the whole intent and purpose of the mother in coming is simply for that purpose. They have no intention necessarily at all of actually living here. In addition, people who come to the United States illegally, who give birth to a child, give birth to a U.S. citizen. That is, even if the person born here is the child of an illegal alien, by U.S. law, that person is a U.S. citizen. Now, the reason I bring this up isn't merely because this issue came up in the presidential debate the other day. It's that the stupidity of this law, the frivolousness with which U.S. citizenship is given in this way to people who are born here, even of illegal aliens, and even of people who come here solely for a kind of tourist citizenship feature, that underscores the frivolousness of American citizenship law. It shows that the United States is not serious about citizenship by allowing this to be in place for as long as it has been. Now, in the debate that came up the other day, several of the candidates did say they would be in favor of repealing the 14th Amendment, of changing the law in that regard. But notably, one candidate, Rick Perry, refused even to respond to the question to deal with it in any way, which will probably cost him some support. But more importantly than this is my point that neither political party over the past century that this law has existed has made any serious effort to change the law, to change the legal situation that means that anyone born here is automatically a citizen. Now, it's a problem today because the problem has grown so great, the immigration issue has become so large, so huge, that now it's being talked about. But the problem has been a serious one for many, many years now, and the failure of political leaders of both the Democratic and Republican Party to deal with this and to change this underscores, points up, the lack of seriousness in our society. In a mass democracy, and particularly here in the United States, over and over again, problems are not even acknowledged or much less dealt with until the problem has become so great that it is very difficult, even if impossible, to overcome and to solve. And that's true, I think, of the immigration problem. It's now become so great, so huge, that any solution is going to be difficult, if not really impossible. And that's why solutions as drastic as a large fence along the border are now seriously talked about in this debate and around the country. But a country led by people who think ahead, who look ahead, and who have a abiding concern for the long-term welfare of the society would have dealt with this problem many, many years earlier. Republicans generally look back at the presidency of Ronald Reagan with great admiration and even nostalgia. Ronald Reagan is considered by most Republicans as the exemplary Republican leader of modern times. But it's remarkable that Ronald Reagan himself skirted and did nothing serious about the problem of immigration when he was president. The same debate was taking place 20, 30 years ago, including during the administration of Ronald Reagan, and he dealt with that problem not by handling it in any comprehensive or serious way, but instead by supporting a program, a policy of amnesty for millions of illegal immigrants. And that merely postponed the problem, put it off, and made it even worse. But that's typical of American society today, the lack of principle, the lack of seriousness, the kind of frivolous way that politicians in our society deal with problems. Ronald Reagan is held up now by many Republicans as an icon, but the reality of the Reagan administration is very different than the image that many Republicans like to hold up about his presidency. More specifically, Ronald Reagan came to office promising to reduce federal government, to eliminate the departments of education and other branches of the federal government. But after coming to office, Reagan did none of those things. In fact, he increased the federal government during that time. And to so increased federal spending that the debt and the indebtedness and the spending of the Reagan administration was unprecedented up to that time, except perhaps during World War II. But Ronald Reagan was rightfully called the great communicator. He spoke very eloquently, and for many millions of Americans, that was enough. It didn't matter what he actually did. The important thing was he sounded good. And politician after politician has learned that crucial lesson of American politics, that the most important thing is to sound good, is to be persuasive. The actual policies don't really matter. There's no one who has followed that recipe for success better than the current president, Barack Obama, who became president largely on the basis of his rhetoric, not what he actually had done, not on the basis of anything concrete, but on the basis of his promises and his smooth talk. So high were the expectations raised by Barack Obama that around the world, millions of people looked upon a Obama presidency with high hopes and expectations, so much so that he was given the Nobel Peace Prize, perhaps the most coveted award that any person in the world can be given, not for anything he had actually done, but for his rhetoric and expectations about what he would do. And the reality of the Obama administration, just like the reality of the Ronald Reagan administration and of other recent American administrations, has been in sharp contrast to the rhetoric of these men before they came to office. And again, this is no especially true with regard to the Republican icon of the 20th century, Ronald Reagan, who in his policies did things that many Republicans today would consider liberal or betraying. The Tea Party people who insist that illegal aliens should be expelled from the country, many of them admire Reagan, who actually gave amnesty. Reagan shored up and strengthened the U.S. Social Security system, which is contrary to certainly the rhetoric that he had made as a candidate. And he enormously increased government spending. Now, the reality, therefore, of this man, of Ronald Reagan, points up this inherent weakness in the democratic system, whereby leaders are not held accountable for their actions. And, of course, by today's standards, Republican leaders would regard Ronald Reagan as anti-Israel. Republican leaders, Mitt Romney, Rick Perry, Michelle Bachmann, and so forth, condemn Barack Obama for his so-called betrayal of Israel, for his for supposedly not supporting Israel enough because he says that a peace settlement between the Israelis and the Palestinians must be on the basis of the 1967 borders, and because Obama says that Israel should not build more settlements on the occupied West Bank Palestinian territory. Well, this position by Barack Obama is completely in accord with long-standing U.S. policy and was upheld by Ronald Reagan. So by the standards of today's Republicans who condemn Barack Obama, Ronald Reagan would be considered anti-Israel. But, of course, at the time, he was considered a great friend of Israel. The reality is that in his actual policies, Barack Obama has been entirely supportive of Israel, and in his policies he's done nothing concrete to help Palestinians. The only difference is his rhetoric has sounded as if it's more just, more fair, and more pro-Palestinian than that of George W. Bush. In a famous speech he gave in 2009 in Cairo, Barack Obama stressed that the oppression of the Palestinians under occupation, under Israeli occupation, was, as he put it, intolerable. Well, in fact, Barack Obama has shown that the occupation of Palestinians is very tolerable, so tolerable that when push comes to shove, Barack Obama has done nothing to hold Israel accountable for its violation of international law and its rebuking its of the policy of the United States with regard to the occupied Palestinian territories. Well, we'll take a break at this point and come back in a few minutes with the second half of this broadcast.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
So, to explore what the future holds for Greece and the rest of the Eurozone, let's cross now to financial advisor and analyst Patrick Young. He's joining us in Poland tonight. Patrick, good evening. Thanks for being on RT. It's a grim picture we had our correspondent paint there. More bailout, meaning more belt-tightening in Greece, strikes by public servants and other unions against these austerity measures that are crippling their services there. How far do you think this will go? It rumbles on, doesn't it? Especially if the governor approves more cuts Thursday.
Well, look, I think we're actually coming close to the end, really, Kevin, because ultimately the Greek economy is in such a mess, there's simply nothing can be done. I mean, what we're trying to do here is take the world's most obese person and give them a crash diet so they're going to turn into, I don't know, Cindy Crawford by the end of next year. I mean, it's simply impossible. You can't do that. The Greek railways, for example, I mean, the salary bill is something like 100 million euros. The total amount of income is like 100 million euros. And in total, it costs about 700 million euros, I believe, to run the railway system. You cannot possibly manage to change those numbers in such a short period of time. The simple truth is, Greece has too much debt. No matter of belt tightening is going to change it. Now what's going to happen is we're going to have to take what we call in banking terms a haircut on the debt. And ultimately, it's not going to be cutting of the hair. A lot of people are going to be left somewhat bald.
Nicely put, as ever. Can you just talk me through the next bit I wanted to ask you about? Germany's pushing for banks, isn't it, to accept cuts of 50 to 60% on their Greek bond holdings. France, though, says about 20, 21% is enough. Do you think this disagreement is going to affect Sunday's EU meeting, where those final details about Greece's second bailout are expected to be discussed?
Well, you see, the problem here we have is it's a huge ripple effect. Now, so the readers can understand, the listeners can understand, I mean, viewers, a haircut is basically when you say, well, that asset we bought a year ago, it's...
Oh, dear, cut off in his prime. We just lost
the signal. Therefore, a just value.
We
now, the
that.
Marketplace has already basically said that effectively Greek debt is devalued by 50%. However, some governments, particularly the French, are trying to effectively defy financial gravity and say, oh no, hold your nose for a moment. This is actually not such a huge crisis. We can get away with about 20%. Why do they say that? Because the problem is, Kevin, that ultimately these banks in France could themselves end up being in need of government bailout. And the French government don't want to do that because the French government are deeply concerned about their own credit rating for the French government. And Mr. Sarkozy is terrified that he's going to lose...
Let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Hello and welcome back. Much of the news in the past couple of weeks has been given over to reporting about the Occupy Wall Street movement, which has grown from Wall Street in New York across the country and even around the world. The first Wall Street occupation protests that took place have grown in size and grown in scope, fueled tremendously by a lot of attention in the media. Now, the Occupy Wall Street movement is incoherent in many ways. It's unclear confusing about what the people who support this movement actually want, and it represents a lot of anger about and frustration about the increasing disparity of wealth in America, and of course unhappiness about the high unemployment, home foreclosures, the general economic difficulty, and so forth. But here I want to talk about, and the Occupy Wall Street movement has many parallels on the, you might say, Democratic or liberal side with the Tea Party movement, which has generally been associated with conservatives and Republicans. But, and it's hard to say where this is all going to go, except that almost certainly it represents a real, palpable, genuine sense of frustration, anxiety, apprehension about the future, not only in the United States, but in Europe as well, that represents a kind of a crisis of trust for American society and Western society generally. Now, there's been some discussion during the past week that some of those who have been in the Occupy Wall Street movement have criticized the role of Jews in Wall Street and of Jewish power in American society. Of course, in any society, responsibility for what goes well or what goes wrong is lies above all in those who have power and authority in that society. People who exercise and wield power and influence can be and or should be held accountable for the consequences of their power, influence, and authority. But that's why much of the focus of the Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street movement, and much of this has been misguided or mistargeted. Just the other day, a woman in the Occupy Wall Street movement in Los Angeles, a woman named Patricia McAllister, was interviewed and emphasized the role of Jews in Wall Street and the power that Jews have in American finance. She was so enraged by this that she said that Zionist Jews should be removed from the country. Well, for this remark, she was fired from her position as a substitute teacher with the Los Angeles Unified School District, one of the largest in the country. And she was condemned widely for saying this. A number of Jewish commentators have expressed alarm by the anti-Jewish flavor, as some of them say, of some of the Occupy Wall Street protests. In Israel, the largest circulation daily newspaper called the anti-Semitic outbursts, quote, hard to watch, and an Israeli commentator said, it's just like pre-World War II Nazi Germany. You think blood libels can't happen in America? ? Well, that's overstated, of course. America is not like Germany in the 1920s or 30s. But nonetheless, there have been some remarks like this. But what's the reality behind these statements? How much power and influence do Jews have in American finance, and particularly in Wall Street? Well, one of the most popular radio hosts in Southern California is a Jewish American, born in South America, actually, a Jewish talk show host named Bill Handel. Bill Handel is on every morning on KFI radio, and he also does a nationally syndicated show about legal affairs. And during a recent broadcast, when he was when there was discussion involved the Occupy Wall Street movement, Bill Handel made the remark, "It's my tribe that controls Wall Street. Why should I be upset?" Well, that's pretty remarkable. Bill Handel is often a person who says what he thinks, and oftentimes in a half-serious way. But for saying that my tribe, Jews, control Wall Street, he'll probably get away with it and not be condemned in the way that others might because he's himself Jewish. Just on a personal level, I was a guest on the Bill Handel some years ago when he was first starting out his career in Southern California. And I was on for an hour on a radio show, or maybe 2 hours on KFI. So I have some personal involvement with him. But in fact, Jews do have a very large, even dominant position on Wall Street, a fact that has been noted even by some Jewish scholars. One of those who's talked about this is a Jewish scholar named Benjamin Ginsberg. Benjamin Ginsberg has been a professor of political science at the Johns Hopkins University, which is a very prestigious university, of course, in the United States. And he's the author of a book entitled The Fatal Embrace, Jews and the State. In this book, he writes that some 50%, half of Wall Street executives were Jewish when he wrote this book in 1999. It was published in 1999. And the percent of Jews in Wall Street as Wall Street executives is at least as high now as it was when he wrote the book, 1999. But the point here is how little Jews or the media in America is willing or able to acknowledge this reality, the reality of Jewish power and influence in American life. And that's why the points made by Benjamin Ginsberg in this in his book are worth emphasizing and repeating. I have a copy of the book in front of me here, and I'm going to quote from a little bit about this because it's relevant to this discussion going on right now with the Occupy Wall Street movement. Benjamin Ginsberg writes, "Since the 1960s, Jews have come to wield considerable influence in American economic, cultural, intellectual, and political life. Jews played a central role in American finance during the 1980s, and they were among the chief beneficiaries of that decade's corporate mergers and reorganizations. Today, though barely 2% of the nation's population is Jewish, close to half its billionaires are Jews. The chief executive officers of the three major television networks and the four largest film studios are Jews, as are the owners of the nation's largest newspaper chain and most influential single newspaper, the New York Times. In the late 1960s, Jews already constituted 20% of the faculty of elite universities and 40% of the professors of elite law schools. Today, these percentages doubtless are higher." Ginsberg also writes, "Their role, that is the role of Jews, in American economic, social, and political institutions has enabled Jews to wield considerable influence in the nation's public life." Ginsberg goes on to write in his book, "Although they make up only a very small percentage of the total population, they comprise," he writes, "11% of what this study defines as the nation's elites, although he goes on that they constitute more than 25% of the elite journalists and publishers and more than 17% of the leaders of important voluntary and public interest organizations and more than 15% of the top-ranking civil servants." He also makes a point in his book about the way in which Jews played a very major role during the 1980s in the years of the Reagan administration. He says, During the 1980s, the Reagan administration and the Jewish financiers enjoyed a perfect marriage of convenience. As outsiders on the margins of the banking and securities industry, Jews were better able to see and make use of the new opportunities made available by the financial deregulation and permissive climax of the Reagan era. He goes on, the Jews honed the art of risk arbitrage, another field snubbed by WASP Wall Street. Jewish newcomers and a few of their non-Jewish allies saw the possibility of using junk bonds to finance hostile takeover attempts. In their endeavors, the Jewish financiers enjoyed the blessing and protection of the Reagan administration. The administration courted the financiers and protected them from a hostile Congress. Indeed, the Jewish financiers were treated by the administration and the Securities and Exchange Commission as valuable advisors and political allies. For example, Ivan Boesky and Michael Milken, who parenthetically later went to jail, were frequently invited to participate in Securities and Exchange Commission-sponsored conferences and advisory panels to discuss the securities industry and to offer their views regarding the economy and the state of corporate and public finance. Well, the point here is that as the taboo around the entire issue of Jewish power and influence in our society and how reluctant the mass media is in America and, of course, American politicians to acknowledge this reality. But politics is above all a question of power in any society. And in our society, acknowledging this power, much less dealing with it in a forthright way, is almost taboo. But that in a healthy society, there is an acknowledgement and awareness of power and of who carries it out, and a holding of an accountability of those who exercise real power. In recent weeks, also in the news, there's been a great deal of reporting about an amazing claim made by Attorney General Holder that a plot by Iran to assassinate a Saudi Arabian ambassador to the United States was uncovered and foiled. The claim made by the Obama administration has been widely discussed and has been seized upon by those who are hostile, of course, to Iran already to renew and to make louder their calls for war against Iran or new measures against Iran. But the claims by the Obama administration about this alleged Iran assassination plot have raised some very grave questions. It's not widely reported in the United States, it's more reported in foreign countries, that specialists of Iran and the Middle East are very, very skeptical of these Obama administration claims. The Christian Science Monitor, which is one of the more informed and prudent newspapers in the United States, reports, and I'm quoting, Iran specialists who have followed the Islamic Republic for years say that many details in the alleged plot just don't add up. One specialist is quoted as saying, it's a very strange case. It doesn't really fit Iran's mode of operation. The plot doesn't seem to serve Iran's interests in any conceivable way, says the specialist who's with the Rand Corporation in Arlington, Virginia, and co-author of studies about the Iran Revolutionary Guard. The Alexander Coburn, an American or British-American writer, in a column, makes this point. Even by the forgiving standards of American credulity, the supposed Iranian plot to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the U.S. is spectacularly ludicrous. Why would Iran want to kill the Saudi envoy, the mild-mannered functionary Adel al-Jubeir, to kill any ambassador, particularly a Saudi ambassador, is to invite lethal retaliation, even war. Iran doesn't want war with the U.S. The question is why the U.S. government should nail its colors so firmly to the mast of this purported Iranian assassination plot. On two other occasions, the U.S. made passionate commitments at the U.N. to concocted evidence, and he cites this. And this is important because there's a track record of lying and misrepresentation by high-level American officials presenting concocted evidence to justify American military action. The first of these, cited by Coburn and by others, a very high-level one, was the presentation at the United Nations by Secretary of State Colin Powell in February of 2003. This is during the George W. Bush administration. And during that presentation, Colin Powell presented his infamous dossier of bogus evidence, entirely phony evidence, that Iraq had a huge arsenal of weapons of mass destruction. And this was cited by the U.S. To help justify the invasion a few weeks later and bombing and occupation of Iran by American troops. The second, cited by Coburn, is the allegation by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Susan Rice in February of this year that Muammar Gaddafi of Libya was committing crimes against humanity up to and including genocide against his own people, charges that have been decisively refuted by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. And Alexander Coburn goes on to stress again that Iran does not want war with the U.S., but asks, rhetorically, how far will the U.S. go in its response led as it is by a weak president always glancing fearfully over his shoulder at the neocons and the war party? Another person who's commented on this is Gareth Porter, a very well-informed reporter for the Interpress Service. He writes, officials of the Barack Obama administration have aggressively leaked information supposedly based on classified intelligence in recent days to bolster its allegation that two higher-ranking officials from Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps were involved in a plot to assassinate Saudi Ambassador Adel al-Jubeir in Washington, D.C. The media stories generated by the leaks help divert press attention from the fact that there is no verifiable evidence of any official Iranian involvement in the alleged assassination plan, contrary to the broad claim being made by the Obama administration. But the information about the Iranian officials leaked to NBC News, The Washington Post, and Reuters was unambiguously false and misleading. Now, very little of this has been reported and highlighted in the American media. Again, there's far more skepticism of this and far more reality about all this in the media outside the U.S. than there is here in this country, which is a media that does more to mislead and misinform the American public than perhaps the media of any other country. And that's why it's very important and valuable to check sources of news other than those from the mainstream media. In the British daily newspaper The Independent, another writer, Patrick Coburn, also deals with this plot and these claims made by the Obama administration. And he writes, under an article headlined, Bizarre Plot Goes Against All That Is Known of Iran's Intelligence Service, Patrick Coburn in The Independent writes, the claim that Iran employed a used car salesman with a conviction for check fraud to hire Mexican gangsters to assassinate the Saudi ambassador in Washington goes against all that is known of Iran's highly sophisticated intelligence service. The confident announcement of this bizarre plot by the U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder sounds alarmingly similar to Secretary of State Colin Powell's notorious claim before the United Nations in 2003 that the U.S. possessed irrefutable evidence that Saddam Hussein was developing weapons of mass destruction. The beneficiaries from such a plot are evident. There will be those on the neocon right and extreme supporters of Israel who have long been pressing for a war with Iran. And that's the crucial point here. First of all, the record of American officials lying about foreign countries to press, prod, and encourage the American public to support war and military campaigns against others is a well-entrenched one in American history. I've talked about this in other podcasts in the past, and perhaps the high point of all of this was by President Franklin Roosevelt in 1940 and 1941, in which over and over in spectacularly exaggerated words, the president claimed that Germany represented a mortal threat to the United States and that Germany was trying to take over the whole world and was plotting to take over the United States. And a high point of that was Franklin Roosevelt's claim that Hitler was trying to take over the whole world, abolish all the religions of the world, including Christianity, Islam, and so forth, and substitute a so-called Nazi religion. Well, all of that was completely bogus and spurious, but if there's any progress that can be pointed out in the years since then, is that the American public is much more skeptical than it was in 1941 because of the years of disappointment and of obvious misrepresentation by American presidents in the last 20 years and even the last few years. And here we go to really the main point. The country that above all, the only country that has a interest in war against Iran is Israel, because Israel regards Iran as fundamentally dangerous to its interests. Around the world, government after government realizes that the only beneficiary of a war against Iran would be Israel. The rest of the world understands, and most Americans understand, I think, or should understand, that war with Iran would be disastrous, catastrophic. And that's why there is such tremendous opposition to it, and why also the media, especially here in the United States, is so eager to try to create incidents or create justifications for a war against Iran. Jim Loeb, writing for the Independent Press Service, comments, "Key neoconservatives and other right-wing hawks who championed the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq are calling for military strikes against Iran in retaliation for its purported murder-for-hire plot against the Saudi Arabian ambassador here. Leading the charge is the Foreign Policy Initiative, the ideological successor to the Project for the New American Century, which played a critical role in mobilizing support for regime change in Iraq in the late 1990s and subsequently spearheaded the public campaign to invade the country after the 9/11 attacks. The beneficiaries of war against Iran, again, primarily, overwhelmingly would be Israel, and that's the main beneficiaries of this fantastic claims of against the new plot. But to go back to the recent presidential, the current presidential campaign and the recent debate, it's worth emphasizing how quick Republican Party leaders have been to cite this supposed plot to justify more military spending and more support, if that's even possible, for Israel and to justify new actions against Iran. Well, that concludes this broadcast of the Mark Rober Report. I hope you'll join me the next time.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time, only on VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.